You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
You can find me on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram.
Hello, everybody. I am Rosalie Contrite, and you are listening to This Catholic Life podcast. Today, we are having a conversation about priestly celibacy with a friend of mine, Father Tom, who is currently a diocesan vocations director, but he wasn't always. Father Tom is actually none other than the priest who more or less got me through my conversion. I still laugh about the day that I met him. I was going to have a statue that I was gifted, blessed, and the woman who gave it to me, her only caveat was that I get it blessed. And she said, "Oh, I know a priest. You should go see him and he can bless it and answer any questions that you may have." And I'm thinking, okay, he's going to be 500 years old and be a totally unrelatable relic who isn't going to answer any of my real questions. So I get there and I have my Mary statue and I walk in and there's this guy sitting at the desk on a MacBook looking pretty much like every other 30-something guy. And I was like, is this his assistant or somebody? This is not the priest. Where's the old guy? Now you have to remember, I'm coming at this as a militant atheist, just sort of researching and dabbling in Catholicism. So I didn't understand what I know now. But thankfully, Father Tom was always patient, always had great answers, and even better book recommendations. So for the priest listeners out there, having good answers matters. Don't shy away from the hard questions. Now, on the topic of hard questions, I want to tackle the topic of priestly celibacy today with someone who knows about it firsthand and also helps others more or less discern if it is right for them. So, Father Tom, now that I have introduced you, feel free to say hello and introduce yourself or add anything else that I left out.
I think you got it all. That's great. But it's great to be on the show and great to be with you. And I've forgotten how long a journey this has been, actually, since you first walked into my office. So this is really cool.
Yes, I have definitely had a change of heart, as it were, toward the church. Instead of always assuming the worst, I know that there are good, solid answers behind every question. And so we should ask them. So I want to start us off by asking if you could define celibacy.
Absolutely. I think, and this is sometimes in the kind of secular culture, celibacy gets thrown around there in regard to celebrities and things like that. And what they actually mean by that is, oh, they're refraining from sexual activity for a period of their life or something like that. Therefore, they're going celibate for a year or something. No, celibacy in our tradition obviously has to do with not marrying, and in particular not marrying for the sake of the kingdom of God. So it's not exactly the same as chastity, but obviously it entails chastity. Everybody's called to chastity. Regardless, you know, whatever their state in life is, they're called to chastity according to their state in life. So married people are going to live chastity, obviously different than a celibate priest does, you know. So we understand that much. But celibacy really is in regard to marriage. And so that's, you know, the basic definition. It's been, you know, the longstanding tradition of the Catholic Church that its priests not marry. That's not always been the case in the history of the Church, which we can talk about certainly. But it's the tradition, and that's the current practice, with a few minor exceptions.
This really brings me to my next question, which is, what is the history of celibacy? I know that they did change it at one point.
I think the kind of classic thing that you hear is, oh, well, all priests were married prior to the Middle Ages, and then because they were passing down church property to their progeny, then they were, you know, and everything was getting corrupt, and they changed this, and they made celibacy mandatory. That's kind of the story that's peddled out there. And I think there may be some truth to kind of the practicalities of, well, what happens with church property, with, you know, children of priests and things like that. And I have no doubt that there's some truth to that. But I think to assume that all priests were married before that, obviously that's not the case. I would say probably the majority were not married, or at least many were celibate. And I think we have to take it back even further than that. Let's not forget that from the best evidence that we have, Jesus was celibate. And he talked about the value of celibacy for the sake of the kingdom in the context of his teaching on marriage. And as best we know from the apostles, they were also celibate. We know that Peter was married because he had a mother-in-law, and you can't have a mother-in-law without being married. But we still don't know anything really about whether or not Peter maybe had been a widower or something like that. There's no mention of his wife, which is kind of odd because you would think she would feature at least a minor part somewhere in there. So, I mean, there's good evidence based on the celibacy of Jesus himself, the celibacy of the apostles, at least most of them, celibacy of priests that were successors of the apostles for several centuries, obviously. There's a good tradition and a good momentum of celibacy going into the Middle Ages. So it's not as though someone scratched their head in the Middle Ages and said, oh, I have an idea, let's start doing this. It was there before, and so it was really nothing new. It became mandatory at that point, which it is now. And mandatory is also kind of a loaded word, because when you hear mandatory, you think, oh, this is being imposed on the church. This is something they have to do. I have no doubt that there are priests out there, some, that feel like, oh, this is something that they had to endure. And every priest on any given day could feel that. But I would bet most of my brother priests, and myself included, you know, we feel like this is something that I willingly chose, and I felt called to this. This was not something that was being imposed on me from outside. Yes, I knew it was the practice of the church, but I knew that on day one when I was signing up for the seminary, so it didn't come as a shock, you know. And I always tell people I felt like my call to the priesthood and my call to celibacy came kind of in parallel tracks. They came together. In fact, when I started in college seminary, I left at the end of my freshman year, beginning of sophomore year, and part of the reason I left seminary was I was thinking, I think I might be called to marriage, and part of that was that I had met a young woman. I thought, well, maybe I want to get to know, I like her, I want to get to know her, and so I ended up dating her, but I couldn't shake the whole priesthood idea, and so I was really, through that process, discerning a call to celibacy is what I was doing. I ended up breaking up with her thinking, okay, I'm going to be like in this perfect neutral territory where I'm not in the seminary and I'm not in a relationship with somebody. And then I ended up meeting another young woman. I thought, oh, well, maybe this is the right person. Same thing repeated again, where I didn't really feel called to a longer relationship with this person. I felt called to celibacy. And the moment I decided to break off that relationship and go back to the seminary, oh, lo and behold, there was this peace and this sense that, I'm where I need to be. So I think that might not be every priest's story. I mean, there may be priests that really, really, really struggled with this and still struggle with this, and it is a real sacrifice on a daily basis. But I think all priests, at least to some degree, really felt strongly called to celibacy, so it's not just this burden.
I want to point out one quick thing, and I think it was Fulton Sheen who used to say, "The priest is not his own." And this isn't meant to insult priests who are married, because, of course, there are wonderful married priests who do juggle it all. But in general, I think parish life does not practically lend itself to the average marriage life. It's with children that you need to be there for them, and you also need to be there for your parishioners.
And I think there's some truth to that, but I would caution you on this, and that is, it's very easy to go just to the kind of practicality of celibacy. Like, this would be highly impractical for a person to be married and to do the work that they're called to do for the sake of the gospel as a priest. And then guess what? There's a whole bunch of permanent deacons out there and some married priests out there through various exceptions that are saying, what am I, chopped liver? I have a wife and family, and I'm still able to work for the church and be a family man and a good husband and father. You know, so I get their point. Like they are living out the gospel in a very profound and beautiful way. And so the practical argument, I don't think, gets us all the way there, part of the way there. Yeah, there are definitely some practicalities. You know, I don't have to worry about, oh, I'm sorry, I can't make it to this or that because I've got to go to my daughter's recital or something like that. I get that. But I think in some ways it actually keeps us from talking about the real reason for celibacy, which is spiritual more than it is practical.
I am glad that you brought that up because I really thought of it more as being practically rooted than being theologically rooted, which it truly is. Could you explain the difference between dogmas, doctrine, and practice for those who don't understand?
Sure. So obviously there was a practice of married priests. There's no clear indication from Jesus that, priests had to be celibate or something like that, even though he was celibate, even though it seems that his apostles were celibate. So this has always and forever in the church's tradition been seen as a practice, something that can change, not a dogmatic thing. And of course, there's this whole other church, right? The Eastern churches that have the practice, longstanding practice of having married priests. Their bishops are not married. Their bishops are chosen from among the celibate clergy. But in the Eastern Church, there's a very strong tradition of that. So this is something that could change. Do I see it changing? Not likely, but I suppose it's on the table. And we have seen some exceptions to the rule.
One thing I want to add is that just because in the Eastern Rite you can marry, not all priests do, and they are not down on the practice of celibacy. A lot of them have a great respect for it. Even the married priests speak of the theological value, and so they still think it's very, very important. And there is a priest by the name of Father Michael O'Loughlin, and he is a Byzantine priest, and he talks about how he could get married as a Byzantine priest, and when it was time to get ordained, he was kind of like, I've got to find a wife ASAP. And then he realized, I'm not called to marriage, I'm called to be celibate. And so he is a priest today. He could have married, but he didn't. So I think it's important to show that not every priest would get married, even if they could. We have to go to a break, and we will be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
All right, we're back, and we are with Father Tom, a diocesan vocations director. He is talking to us today about the practice of priestly celibacy. So, Father Tom, can you tell us, do you see change possibly coming? If it did come, what would it look like? Do you see a married priesthood at all in the Roman Rite?
Excellent question. If this were ever to change, I think people have this idea that somehow this would change overnight. I don't think so, because I think, like anything in the church, it would take some time to roll out. I think, obviously, seminary formation would have to adapt itself to kind of accommodate for the fact that you're going to have married men who have, you know, wives and children and things like that. I have no idea what that could possibly look like, but I imagine it would be, on a practical level, very difficult to implement. But nothing's impossible, I suppose. It could be done somehow. One of the things, and I don't know if I'm alone in this or not, but I've often thought that if we did make this change and it just became kind of optional celibacy, one of the thoughts I had on it would be, would it end up being, in a sense, not optional celibacy, but mandatory marriage? Now, let me explain what I mean. Say celibacy is made optional. Say a young man is discerning the priesthood and does not feel particularly called to married life, feels called to celibacy, but for the sake of maybe wanting to relate better to married couples in future ministry, or maybe for the sake of avoiding some stigma, like, will people wonder what's wrong with me because I never got married, because I never felt called? They'll wonder if there's some other reason why he chose not to be married. Or if the Western Church followed the practice of the Eastern Church and only chose its bishops from the celibate clergy, would this guy be pegged as like a climber right away? Like, oh, well, he must feel like he wants to be a bishop someday, so he's going to, you know, stay celibate. And would you therefore have men that are authentically called to celibacy for the sake of the kingdom that actually reject that because of all of that stigma, and decide, well, I guess I got to get married, you know, or I have to get married before I get ordained, so I got to find somebody quick, you know, to marry. And then they end up maybe making not such a good decision about a whole different vocation, marriage, you know, leading up to priesthood. So I don't know. Now, I think there'd be good and bad and in between probably, but I think those are some considerations we honestly have to take a look at if we ever were.
You are correct. I have heard that it does add what you might call drama. I'm more interested in the Byzantine rite than your average Catholic, your average Roman Catholic anyhow. And I have heard that priests sometimes feel pressure to get married to show that they're humble, that they don't think that they're bishop material and think very highly of themselves. So I could see that being a problem.
Or you end up with priests that are chosen, or bishops that are chosen mostly from monastic communities and things like that, because people get celibacy for monasticism and whatnot, but they don't quite get it when it comes to parish priesthood for some reason. And not that having monastic bishops and bishops from religious life is not a good thing. It is a good thing. We have many of them, obviously, in the church. But are you kind of narrowing the pool of potential bishops?
I would push back on that a little bit and just say that while we have great monastic bishops, in general, I feel like the charism of living monastic life is that you are okay with less social interaction. So I think it might constitute a huge cross for some of them.
I think it would be hard to go from being, you know, a monk to being a diocesan bishop, you know, where you're not that they don't have apostolates outside of the monastery where they are taking care of parishes very often. But, I think it's a very different world.
Speaking of topics being worlds apart, can you talk about the female priesthood, why it gets lumped in with married priests, even though they are not on equal footing, and why one can never happen? Because I see a lot of people lump married priesthood and female priesthood together, but they are not even close.
Well, let me say, I think they're lumped together because they seem to be simple solutions to the vocations crisis, for one. So people think, if we had married priests and if we had women priests, we wouldn't have a priest shortage. So that's why the two get thrown in there together. Both, obviously, I think, also have to deal with sexuality, so I think they get lumped together for that reason. But you're absolutely right. These things are not on equal footing in terms of how we approach them. As we said before, you know, mandatory celibacy is a practice of the church and could change potentially. It's not essential to the priesthood that a man be celibate. But on the issue of reserving the priesthood for men alone, there's a little bit more to go on there. And again, we look at the choice of Christ himself in the Gospels. Certainly he had women that were around him that were very prominent in his ministry, his own mother first and foremost. And yet these women were not chosen for the priesthood, were not chosen as those as part of the 12. And so, you know, there's much more of a sense of this is a sacrament that has been given to us in this particular way, much like the Eucharist has been given to us, etc. And we are faithful to that choice of Christ. I always find it interesting. I think it's in Luke's gospel where before they name, you know, Christ comes down the mountain and he calls the 12 and it names them by name. But before that, he spent the night in prayer, seemingly indicating that, you know, this was not something he was taking lightly. He spent the night in prayer. Then he came down the mountain and he didn't say, okay, I need 12 volunteers. You. No, he called these particular 12. And could it be that they were just all men because Jesus is trying to like fit into the culture and not make too many waves? So he just called men because he knew that would be the easy choice for the time and era that he was living in. I don't buy it, because guess what? Jesus, throughout his 3-year public ministry, is constantly making waves and challenging things. And so I think it's a deliberate choice of Jesus. You know, I suppose we could say, well, why? Why did Jesus make? I don't know exactly. I think there's something about the idea of fatherhood that is essential to it. I think the fact that Christ himself, the second person of the Holy Trinity, was incarnate as a male may have something to do with it. But he did, you know, this is the sacrament as it's been given to us. And so You know, there's more that can go into that. Certainly, it's not a full treatment of the church's teaching on reserving priesthood to men. But I think those are things that we have to consider. And so that really is something which, and of course, John Paul II in his letter to bishops in, I think it was 1994, in Sacerdotalis Ordinatio Sacerdotalis said, at the end of that letter, he said in kind of the most explicit language ever, he used all of that kind of Petrine language, you know, therefore, as it's part of my duty to confirm the brethren in the faith, I declare that the Catholic Church has no authority whatsoever to confer the priesthood upon men. Very interesting wording. Upon women, sorry. Yes, obviously. Yes. So he couldn't change this. And I think it was interesting the way he said that. He didn't say, I don't want to. I don't think it would be wise. I don't like this idea. He said, I don't have the authority. The church doesn't have the authority to change this. And even, you know, Pope Francis, a lot of people are like, oh, Pope Francis has come. He's making waves. He's going to change this in a couple of years or whatever. Even Pope Francis, in an informal interviewed about this, you know, said that door is closed. Of course, a lot of people jumped on that and said, oh, he said door. He didn't say brick wall or anything like that. But I think they misread what he's trying to say, which is that's not a possibility. But
I don't think you've mentioned this yet, so I just wanted to throw this out here. One of the reasons I think the male priesthood is so important is because the church is always described as being a bride, right? She's the bride to Christ's bridegroom. And so as we see them married together, the priest, standing in persona Christi, is also married to her. So in the Catholic Church, we believe marriage is a man and a woman. So, of course, a female priest cannot marry the female church. And I think that's something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very good argument there. I think people outside of the church or who do not see eye to eye with the church on this are going to say, well, that's just the church's language that they're imposing on this relationship of Christ and the church and things like that. So, and actually, that kind of goes back to celibacy and fatherhood, too. The idea of priest as father, spiritual father, you know, I think a lot of people say, oh, that's our cultural language that we've attributed to the priest, or that religion, in particular Christianity, has attributed to the divine, to God. But from our understanding of things, fatherhood really begins with the father, right? So it's the father's fatherhood that spiritual fathers, priests, are called to imitate. And natural fathers, in the same way, they're called to imitate the fatherhood of God, the Father. So, you know, yeah, that's important to us. And I think it's the same issue with bridegroom and bride. It's not that we kind of impose this language, but there is a real sense of Christ as bridegroom first and fundamentally, and the church as his bride that gets reflected, guess what, in married life, but also gets reflected in religious life and in celibacy for the sake of the kingdom.
All right, we have to have a quick break, and when we get back, I have one more question for Father Tom from me, and then we can get to the listeners' questions, which should be good, because they are a lot more blunt than I am.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
All right, we are back from the break. This is Rosalie Contrite, and you are listening to This Catholic Life. We are here with Father Tom, Vocations Director, and he is talking to us about priestly celibacy. So we have one more question from me, and then on to the listener questions. My final question is, do priests ever struggle with loneliness? I'm acquainted with a few faithful families who discourage their boys from vocations because they are pained by the idea that their son would be lonely.
Yeah, I often tell people, you know, especially when it's in parish ministry, there would be Sunday afternoons after some, you know, after masses and maybe like a parish picnic or something like that. And I would go back to the rectory and it would be, you know, all quiet and I'd be kind of lonely and just think about all these families going home and having Sunday afternoon to, you know, be around the house or play games or do, you know. But I also, a lot of Sunday afternoons, went back to the rectory and I thought, oh, thank goodness I can put a baseball game on and take a nap, you know, or get ready for the next thing, you know. So, you know, again, that kind of goes to the practical nature of celibacy a little bit. But Yes, priests can be lonely. Like any human being can be lonely. You know, the saying that you can be lonely in a crowd. You can be married and very lonely. And God knows, as a priest, I've talked to many married couples that are struggling in one way or another. And you find that, yeah, they're lonely in their marriage. This hasn't, like, fixed everything just because they are wedded to this other person. There's things within their own self and within their relationship that they've got to continue to work on. So, yeah, but is the loneliness that a priest experiences worse or different than the loneliness of a married couple or something like that? I don't really know, but I could say, you know, for my experience, there are days I'd like to be lonely. You know, there are days when a little loneliness wouldn't hurt, but no, I never really feel lonely. Most priests that I know don't feel lonely because guess what? If we're doing our job, we're constantly with people. You know, we're constantly surrounding ourselves with a community. The loneliest I feel is when I'm not doing what I should be doing as a priest, or when I feel, you know, when I'm this kind of, I'll go to events, you know, where at first maybe I was thinking, oh, I got to do this thing and I'm not really looking forward to it. And I will go and I will do it and I will leave just beaming, you know, like, this is why I'm a priest. You know, this is what I love to do. I probably am more of an introvert than an extrovert still, but I'm probably somewhere kind of in the middle. Some priests I know are true extroverts where they really do kind of feed off of that interaction with people. And then there's a lot of priests that are true introverts too, where they really need that time of quiet and then they kind of expend their energy with people. But yeah, priests can be lonely, but I don't think it's an occupational hazard that's built in. Not if you're doing your job right.
That's a really great point, because I think a lot of people think loneliness is an inherent risk to the priesthood, but really anybody can be lonely. I know plenty of married people who feel very lonely. So I think you make an excellent point there. The other thing I want to say is I forget which priest said this to me, but he said essentially, you get the grace for your state in life. So I have two kids right now, and the idea of six kids just makes my eyes bug out. But I don't have six kids, so I don't have the grace to deal with them. Just like I can't imagine being alone, but I'm not called to that, so I don't have the grace to do it. And so I think we need to consider that God really does give us what we need in our state in life and the ability to deal with what he's calling us to.
Another point on that is I think when priests do feel lonely, usually they're comparing their life to a life that does not and could never exist. They're comparing their life to a lie. They're comparing their life to this kind of idyllic married life. And to me, that is nothing short of just the deception of the evil one, right? That says, oh, but look at all this that you gave up, this kind of, you know, picture perfect married life and everything like that. So a lot of times when priests are feeling lonely, that's why they're feeling lonely, because they are being confronted with a bold-faced lie about the reality of married love and life and all of that. So when we kind of come back down to earth and realize, wait a second, yeah, marriage is difficult too, and it has its sacrifices, God knows, and difficulties and things like that, and it's beautiful, and yet I'm not called to that. I'm called to this in another way.
The last time I went to confession recently, I just walked in and I was like, I don't know how to confess this, but I really wish I were a nun today. And he just busted out laughing. But I think it brings up a point, and that is, just because I can see the beauty in or desire that vocation for one day, does that mean that I'm actually called to it? No. I mean, just because I desired to be a nun that day doesn't mean that I could make it. They would kick me out. So
I've thought about that about monastic life at times. I'll go up to a monastery for a couple of days and I'm like, ooh, this is good. I could do this. I could see. And then about 3 days in, I'm like, get me out of here. I want to talk to somebody. So
yes, totally. That's it. Exactly. So on to listener questions. The first one is from Anonymous, and Anonymous says, I've heard celibacy was started to stop priests from leaving church property and their lifetime wealth to their families over the church, and the church also wanted to cut what they had to pay priests. Do you dispute this?
I do dispute this, at least in part. I think there may have been something to that reasoning a little bit. They were dealing with what things were getting messy, you know, as the church was more established, was no longer in persecution. And you had these married priests, and maybe some of them were wanting to leave behind things that properly belonged to the church, to their offspring. Yeah, there may have been something there. I would have to do some more homework there, honestly, to kind of get at the foundations of that. But the premise of the question is already wrong in a sense, because it's saying, I hear that this started because, no, this started with Jesus Christ in, you know, his own public ministry and with the choice of the apostles, and was carried on for a good millennium or more before it became mandatory. So it didn't just start there. And it was not just for that kind of very practical, very kind of banal reason. It was for something much deeper, a spiritual reason.
There's also a huge hole in this argument for me, because you can leave things when you die to people who are not your children. You can leave them to your neighbor if you want to. And of course, priests would have had, you know, aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews and siblings. So it doesn't really follow that this would solve that. All right. The next listener question is from Mary B. And I know her personally, so do this one really well. Okay. She says all humans go through puberty and become sexually mature. So it seems like celibacy requires priests to suppress a major part of their humanity. Isn't it unnatural? And don't you think this suppression is the reason for scandals?
Aha. I think this is very prevalent among people, and especially young people. And I think part of it is fed from this idea that if you are not acting out in some way, shape, or form, your sexuality, whether with others, whomever that may be, or by yourself, there's something deficient in you. There's something that maybe your psychosexual development is not where it should be, and things like that. And guess what? You are going to spontaneously combust, inevitably, because this is just something that's built into us. And I will say, I think there was an era in formation of priests in the world and in our own country where kind of the suppression model may have been more in vogue, where it's just like, you need to kind of stuff this. Well, I don't think that worked out so hot, you know, and I think an authentic integration of one's sexuality. In fact, this is really the definition of chastity, right, is to integrate one's sexuality in an appropriate way. It doesn't say you must be married and you must be sexually active in order to be psychosexually healthy. Of course not, you know. And what do we say of the person who is not called to priesthood or religious life, but is neither called to marriage, you know? Like, is there something fundamentally wrong with them? Not necessarily. Can they live out as their sexuality in an appropriate and chaste way? Yes, they can, you know. So the question, again, is already kind of buying into a lie, I think, that the culture tells us, which is there's something wrong with you if you're not sexually active in some way, shape, or form. And in fact, we find a lot of unhealthy behaviors among people that are very sexually active. So yes, you can have celibates that are perhaps, maybe their psychosexual development was stunted and that didn't get weeded out somewhere in the seminary process or something like that. But, you know, I think the seminary process today especially is trying to really tackle this head on. If anything, my seminarians are probably hit over the head with this in seminary, and so they almost get tired of hearing it. Not that it's not important, but it's become so big that they hear it all the time. But so I think you can certainly have a healthy psychosexual development and feel called to celibacy and to the priesthood. Again, it's not something being imposed, but something that you feel called to, and there's nothing wrong with you. The other thing about this would be, was Jesus somehow not psychosexually healthy in his celibacy? Were the apostles not? I don't think so. I think Jesus is a great example of someone who's a healthy man in all ways, spiritually, psychologically. And so that calls into question his own celibacy.
I think you bring up an excellent point in that we're buying into this lie that you must be sexually expressing yourself some way or something's wrong. Until the last century or so, people were mostly chaste. They used to be called old maids. We call them cat ladies now. But there was nothing inherently wrong with those women because they weren't in a sexual relationship. Let's say they were being chaste, because I'm sure not all of them were. And I think that because we live in a society where almost nobody is chaste, nobody understands chastity anymore or self-mastery. This is why we have people having such a hard time with the concept of NFP. Let's say in your marriage, you cannot get pregnant for some very serious reason. This means you have to abstain so you do not become pregnant. And we have people exclaiming, see, the church is totally unreasonable. Look what they're asking us to do. And I think that says a lot about what we think about sex when it hasn't been seen this way in other times in history.
There's this great irony right now in our time of, on the one hand, the exaltation of the human person as God, basically, and at the same time, basically telling all human beings, you're an animal. You can't control yourself. You can't make choices. You're an animal. You have to act on those instincts. It's this weird paradox.
It's interesting because some people will claim that, you know, we're post-reproduction. We're more civilized than acting as animals just trying to reproduce. And yet they're saying that we are like animals. We have to give in to all of our impulse. All right. We need to go to a break. So when we come back, I will have more listener questions for Father Tom.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, we are back from the break, and I am Rosalie Contrite, and you are listening to This Catholic Life podcast. We are here with Father Tom, who just addressed why celibacy is not a suppression of a part of your humanity. And one thing that I wanted to address that kind of popped up in my mind while he was talking is that sometimes atheists and even Catholics will say that scandal is proof that this is not the true church, that it proves that this cannot be the church that Christ founded. To which I say we really need to acknowledge that right off the bat, Peter, who Christ very purposefully selected, denied Christ three times. And I think we forget how grievous that is because Peter actually knew Christ. So we need to remember that nowhere was it ever stated that the Pope would be 100% moral, that he would never make a mistake, that he would never sin. It's not something that we see Christ telling us, and he shows us very clearly by selecting 12 apostles who are extremely flawed. We have one who sold God's life for 30 pieces of silver, and we have Peter who denied him.
How is it that we can have a church, we want a church that goes out to sinners, and at the same time we say, but you can have no sinners in your church? You know, it doesn't make sense. You can't really have it both ways. It doesn't surprise me a bit that we've had struggles, you know, over our 2,000-year history, because we have always been made up of human beings that are sinners, and from Peter on down, as you mentioned, have failed in some way, and there's need for reconciliation, there's need for mercy there. So, that's not proof for me at all. If anything, the fact that we have survived not only persecutions from the outside and all sorts of wars and the rise and fall of empires, but the fact that we have actually survived ourselves and our own sinfulness and our own scandal is proof to me that there's something more to this church than just us, that the Holy Spirit is driving this boat, because we should have shot ourselves in the foot on day two, pretty much.
It always amazes me how alarmist people can be about current popes and the effect they're going to have on the church. I wrote a blog post recently called So You Don't Like Pope Francis, and in it I say, we survived the bourgeois and we will survive Francis. And it's not that I think anything is glaringly wrong with Francis, but the point is people are acting like the world is going to end because they don't like everything he says or does. And we forget what our church has really survived and what it means that the gates of hell will not prevail against us. Now I have one more question for you from a listener. The question is from Violet, and in parentheses it says, not my real name. She asks, what determines what sacraments a deacon can administer? They would be a lot more useful if they could do more. Can this change?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I honestly would have to do a little bit more homework there. I do work with our deacon formation program a little bit, and so I get to know them pretty well, and Obviously, deacons in relationship to the bishop, in a sense, have even a more direct relationship almost than a priest, and certainly in the history of the development of these orders, right? The apostles were the first priests, but they're also the first bishops. They're kind of like one and the same thing. And eventually, you know, as we read about in Acts, they need some help. They get these seven reputable men that are ordained through imposition of hands as deacons to serve at table, you know, and then the kind of the splitting off of presbyters as collaborators, co-workers with the bishop, that distinction comes a little bit later. But it's very clear that from the beginning, deacons were not doing the same things as the apostles were doing. The fact that priests can basically do everything that a bishop can do minus ordination is kind of telling. You know, I can confirm, you know, in an emergency case or with the bishop's permission, you know, like at the Easter Vigil or something like that, obviously, you know, all of the other sacraments I can do, the bishop can do as well. I can't ordain, obviously, but deacons really, they can baptize, they can witness marriage outside of Eucharist, they can preside at a funeral outside of Mass. So it's pretty clear that they were always seen as a kind of a helper to the bishop slash priest. And so there's not really any evidence of them having celebrated other sacraments and then those having been taken away from them at some point. And I don't see that changing, again, for practicality. If we're going to basically say, well, the permanent deacons may now celebrate Mass and do this, that, and the other, then we might as well have, then we have, or we have married priests, you know.
Essentially, yeah. Do you think there's ever going to be a bishop, Tom? Maybe you'll be able to ordain at some point, huh?
Yeah, no comment.
I'm going to start the hashtag Tom for Bishop. We're going to get that going.
I'm waiting for them to put in a height requirement to definitively rule me out. So, yeah. No thanks.
On the topic of height, I noticed that when you left, I think you left some of your chasubles, and you're so much shorter than whoever came after you, and so they were, like, at his knees, and it was a little bit laughable.
Well, what normally happens is I go someplace, and, you know, I'm having to, like, you know, make sure I'm not stepping on the hem of this thing as I'm walking up the steps to the sanctuary, so... There's just no place in the church for a short priest anymore.
We will always have a place for you here on This Catholic Life, even if you are short. I'm also short, so this is a show for short people. No, I'm just kidding. We have one more question for you from Michelle V. And she says, respectfully, wouldn't priests be better able to relate to married couples and families if they actually had spouses and children? I love my priest, but he has no idea what it's like to be married, and I feel like his advice reflects that.
Yeah. I mean, I think they have a point, and their listener has a point in that there are some things that a priest could know, in a sense, from the inside that he obviously isn't privy to as a celibate. But let's not forget, first of all, that this priest came from a family and came from a marriage, maybe a very good marriage, hopefully a very good and healthy marriage, and we certainly look for that in candidates, but not always. Sometimes we have candidates that came from broken homes or difficult marriages or difficult situations, and even that they can learn from in kind of the via negativa, but they learn from that in some way. So it's not as though they're kind of raised in a cocoon that they know nothing about marriage or family life or love or relationship. They do just by their upbringing. Many of them maybe were in dating relationships, very serious dating relationships. I've known priests that were just about to be married, that were actually engaged. And so they know about some aspects of that, certainly. There's still some things where, yeah, maybe I'm not going to be able to see quite with the same insight. On the other hand, I'm also not going to be tainted by my own experience of married life and bring my junk into this person's problem, you know, thinking, well, yeah, oh gosh, my wife does that too, or we have the same issue, or that kind of thing. You know, so in a way, the priest has a privileged space to come in as kind of an outsider and look at this from a spiritual perspective and to suggest some things that might seem at times impractical at first, and we might just chalk that up to the fact, oh, he's not married. But maybe actually there is some nugget of truth there, or some wisdom that could be applied in the relationship. So I think there may be some downsides, but I think there's also a lot of positives to having a celibate priest.
I did want to add one thing on this topic, this argument, and that is the priest's main job is not to be a marital counselor, though I do love to get counseling advice from, you know, you and other priests. You could also go to your deacon. Your youth minister might be married. So there are good sources for that, and I feel like it's forcing the priest to be responsible for being the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, and it's too much.
We have classes in seminary, formation classes in pastoral counseling and that kind of thing, but we're not trained counselors or psychologists. And so when I am meeting with a married person or a married couple, I am very fine with telling them when I'm out of my depth and saying, you know, you really ought to see a marriage counselor and then try to make a good recommendation of hopefully a Catholic or at least Christian counselor who's not going to say, oh yeah, you guys need to get divorced right away or something like that. So I know that I can't do everything for them. You know, I kind of look at it more as pastoral counseling, spiritual direction, that sort of thing, obviously the sacraments. But, you know, I'm not going to try to pretend that I can solve all their problems. I can't.
I also like to use the analogy of a physician when I talk about this to other people, and I kind of think of priests like theological physicians, in that a doctor does not need to actually have cancer in order to know how to treat it, and he will have had other patients who have walked this path before that he gains wisdom from. So I think we need to remember that they don't have to have experienced every single thing in life to be able to speak to it. Now, we have about 2 minutes left, so Father Tom, before you leave, is there anything else on this topic that you would like to say, wisdom you want to share with us?
I would say this, regarding celibacy in particular. You know, I will often tell guys that are thinking about priesthood, but maybe the thing that is the glue underneath their feet is that they maybe want to be married and have a family. I always tell them, to me, that's a good indication. The fact that there is a desire for natural fatherhood tells me this guy could also probably be a good spiritual father. For the person that comes up to me and says, oh, I think I'm called to be a priest because I can't stand the idea of marriage and I hate children, I say, no, thank you. Come back or don't come back. You know, I think these things are closer than we realize. And I think it's even reflected in that passage in Matthew 19 where first Jesus is talking about marriage. And then this question comes about, well, then who should marry? And then he talks about celibacy for the sake of the kingdom. These things are mutually beneficial to each other.
I think that's very true. I think you need to be able to see everyone as your spiritual child. I know when I was converting that you were very fatherly toward me, and that dynamic was so helpful. And I know I was a bit of a crazy person when I was converting. Conversion is hard, guys. It is not for the faint of heart. But Father Tom, thank you so much for stopping by. I know that we will ask you to come back again to break down some myths, answer some questions. But until that time, this has been Rosalie Contrite, and you are listening to This Catholic Life podcast.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.